Can you believe it? This is the 50th episode of the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, where I speak with authors, journalists, essayists, and documentary filmmakers about creating works of nonfiction. Unbelievable. Thank you so much for your support. And an especially heartfelt thank you goes out to those of you who reviewed the podcast on iTunes. At this recording, there are 6 5-star reviews. What a gift. I can't tell you how excited that made me to see that start to tally up on iTunes. Like I said, what a gift. And you know what sort of rhymes with gift? Riff. All right. I know I said last week I was through with the riff gags, including this past one that I came up with. I came up with 2 more, so you'll have to bear with me in the following weeks. But the podcast continues to gain momentum, and that's due in part to all the sharing and reviews. So please review the podcast if you have 60 seconds, and share it with all your friends who love a little nonfiction in their lives. So this milestone episode brings you Ted Conover, whose latest book, Immersion, A Writer's Guide to Going Deep, by University of Chicago Press, takes the writer and shows her how to immerse herself into the lives and subcultures of those folks around her so that she may write about it later. Conover's made a career of doing this type of deep dive, whether it's riding the rails as he did for his first book, Rolling Nowhere, crossing the Mexican border as he did in Coyotes, or becoming a corrections officer as he did in New Jack, to detail the lives inside our prison system. Whatever it is, he's all in. And he grew up around Denver and admired how some of the older kids went on these adventures. Some even rode the rails. It got Ted thinking, what would that be like? So toward the end of his time at Amherst College, he left. And in his words, to get out of the library.
After all the books that you've written and articles that you've written, like, at what triggered the need, or what like itch did writing Immersion scratch for you? Like, what was the impetus behind it after doing all the work you've done to then like give this, this wonderful handbook to people looking to employ the sort of tactics that you've used for 40 years?
So it's funny, I did not start out to be a writer known for a particular approach. Immersion was a label applied to my work by somebody else who noticed a pattern in the ways I was approaching things. And I sort of was interested, but not that interested in that pattern initially. I thought, that's cool, but I do other stuff too. And in fact, I'm sure most of my work over the years has been long form, but only immersive occasionally or in certain ways. But after I wrote my last book of journalism, The Roots of Man, which has these 6 immersive chapters, an editor said to me, would you ever consider writing a book about this kind of work? That would use your own experiences and experiences of people you admire to explain, what works and what works less well, et cetera. And I saw in that a chance to, add coherence between my writing life and my teaching life, because I had approached that question in a sort of piecemeal way in different courses I've taught. But I'd never thought of assembling it into a statement about how a person might do this for a range of topics and in a way that took you from the beginning, how you think of an idea to how you get access to how you comport yourself once you're inside to how you structure it, how you report for structure. And then, aftermath, I saw the chance to sort of make sense of that in a coherent, point A to point Z way. And I thought, that actually might be enjoyable. And it was. It was a really fun book to write. It also seemed like, yeah, that's actually, if I'm ever going to do a book about writing, that this is it. Let's just say I felt I had the authority to do it, right?
Yeah,
I thought, yeah, at this point, I guess I am qualified to write this book, and I will. So, yeah.
I think what I especially loved about it was that even though you do talk about writing towards the end of it, I love that it's really like a handbook for the process of doing the type of experiential, experimental, and reporting experience. You know, the writing comes later, but it's like, I like that it's more of a handbook to like get the information and then process
good,
it
no.
later. Yeah.
And thanks for noticing that. It's so funny. I teach at writers' conferences. I enjoy them. It's really fun to work with pros to make it better. But so often when I'm only with somebody for a couple weeks, like at Breadloaf or something, I think we should have had this conversation a year ago before you sat down to write, because the research you do is determinative, right? It defines what you're going to be able to write in many ways. And that's not true with fiction, but with nonfiction, it absolutely is. And if we're writing about experience, there's a lot of thinking that can go into figuring out what kind of experience could be helpful and how to get it, how to have that experience. And so, yeah, that to me was the part that other books hadn't attended to, was the reporting piece and the access part and the taking notes. It's so basic. It almost seems like, it's like people think I'm going to be telling them about my shorthand or something, but in fact, it's this deeply important part of producing good long form nonfiction. And so, yeah, I felt there was a gap there too.
And so, as you get to Amherst, and then you're contemplating riding the rails, not necessarily as you write in immersion, you didn't necessarily know what it meant to write a book. You didn't even know if you could, but there was an experience you wanted to have nonetheless. So sort of like take us to that moment leading up to when you were thinking about taking that on as a project. And, what were you thinking as you were looking to take that leap into something so sort of really audacious and fun and adventurous?
Sure. Well, I think one thing I was thinking is, how could I write a thesis and get out of the library? Because, we were not encouraged to do our own field work as undergrads. In fact, they said it basically wasn't allowed. And yet I thought, well, that's the gist of anthropology. It's this idea that you can learn not just by interviewing people, which I knew about from having worked as a reporter for my school papers and for some suburban papers outside Denver, but being able to live with somebody and participate in their lives could take this to the next level. And I thought that was something profoundly interesting about anthropology, that journalists could learn from, and that I could see nonfiction writers I admired trying, like Tom Wolfe with The Right Stuff, which is just a really entertaining ethnography of fighter pilots in a way. In high school we had all read Truman Capote, and that idea of just getting inside the minds, not just of important people with titles who you talk to as a journalist, but murderers. I mean, somebody like that, it's okay to get to know them and try to explain what's in their heads. That was a mind-bending idea for me. And no one was saying anthropology could help you with this, but it just seemed kind of clear that maybe it could. So, yeah, on the one hand, I was interested in an adventure, such as riding the rails might be, and in staying out of the library. But on the other hand, I thought, you know, this is a legit subject. You could do participant observation by riding the rails. You could attempt an ethnography of people who live like this. And you could do it at age 21, which I was, for almost no money, and get, hopefully, credit for it. So that was kind of my starting point. As you mentioned, I wasn't thinking in terms of a book then, because I didn't know people who wrote books. They weren't in my circle. I'd met professors who had, and a couple of speakers to college who seemed to be making a living that way. But it was, you know, I hadn't started aiming that high yet. And so it wasn't until afterward, when I'd had the experience, I'd written my thesis, and along the way I wrote an article for a student magazine I was involved with about one morning with one hobo. And that got published, and then it got a lot of attention. And that's when I thought, wow, people are interested in this. Maybe this is my moment. Maybe I should see if I can interest a publisher in it as well.
That's great. And it's so sort of elucidating that you said that you used the word moment, because that's kind of like my follow-up to that was, like, was this the moment that essentially changed the trajectory of your life?
Definitely it was, because, in fact, as I prepared to graduate from college, I had lined up a summer job with a newspaper called the Indianapolis Star, which was basically the only one I could get that I was aware of. And I was expected there in June, but in May, the Associated Press noticed my article about the one morning with the one hobo, which had been reprinted in the college magazine. And the publicity that generated just made me think, gosh, maybe I should devote my energy to seeing if I can get a contract for a book instead of moving to Indianapolis. And I thought, either, you know, I am shooting my career in the foot in the most spectacular way right now, or I'm making a decision that might work out. And I think at the end of the day, all I knew is I'd feel bad if I never tried, right? If I didn't see if I could publish a first person account of this. And one thing led to another, and I did. I got a contract. I found an agent who'd grown up in Burlington, Iowa, where the Burlington Railroad began, and things just seemed to fall into place. So yes, that was the beginning, and I part of it was luck that I made. I often think, what if I'd been a little more cautious? I probably would have missed out, and I can't tell you what I'd be doing today. I hate to think about it.
Yeah, because you had maybe the courage to just get out of the, as simple as it sounds, just to get out of the library. You know, it's a safe place to hole up and do research, but, like, because you had a little inkling to just get outside, it, like you said, like, you don't want to ruminate too much about what could have been, but that was like a defining moment, just to think outside of the library, if you will.
I know. I like the way you put it, as though it's something admirable. To me, it showed some sort of weakness of character that I had, trouble concentrating in the library that long. I thought, if I were a real student, I could handle this. But yeah, I was definitely seeking alternatives to formal education, no question.
So what was the appeal to doing this type of research and reporting that is more congruent, as you said, with ethnographies and anthropology versus like straight up journalism, even though this immersive type of stuff really has a ton of overlap.
There is a ton of overlap, but what they have in common and what was the appeal, I think, is this idea of learning from experience. You know, there's a little vogue in this in the 60s and 70s when I was growing up. Professors would send their students out to you know, a little town with $20 and see if they could you know, get by for 24 hours somehow. Could they make it? Could you learn by doing? And I guess I like the idea of experiential education. I think I've benefited hugely from formal education, from books and from lectures by smart people. But I think I've probably benefited equally by getting outside the academy and into the worlds of people who would not be so comfortable there, whether it's railroad tramps or immigrants or prison officers, right? They have coherent cultures that are just sort of incompatible with the politeness of higher education. But, you know, I thought they had things to teach me as well. And I thought that in gaining an experience of living with them, I could, you know, not only learn something that I could write about, but it would be so cool. It would be just such a great thing to have done. So it's this, I think it's partly this idea of what's a worthwhile experience? What do you seek out for fun? Is it riding a motorcycle? Is it visiting Paris? Or, you know, is it this? For me, it was this kind of travel, which I think of as a kind of foreign travel. It's definitely travel outside my comfort zone and into a place that's unknown to most people like me. But on the other hand, if you've grown up with the privileges of education and, you know, a family that's helped get you on your way, then maybe you ought to take some chances and poke your head into places that you don't normally, or you normally wouldn't go. So yeah, to me, that's just been its own reward, even though sometimes it's unpleasant. This whole idea of gaining experience, or experience that doubles as research, is to me just really cool.
It also puts you almost like on their team as well, because like as you experience it, you in essence become initiated, and then in that sense, like you're able to gain an even greater sense of trust that, you know, like, oh yeah, he's kind of one of us now. And you know, you always, you know, you have to be mindful of that distance that ultimately you're going to be writing about these people, and you know, with the notebook out or recorder out, that's your signal to them, be like, listen, like, let's not mistake roles here. But by experiencing this stuff, like, you are proving to them that you are of them, and then you kind of gain their respect, and as a result you can write about them more honestly with greater empathy, and sort of just garner a greater sense of camaraderie that you can translate to the page better.
So that is all true. That is one of the benefits of a, you know, immersive style of reporting that I like to do, is that you can't spend a lot of time. Most of us can't spend a lot of time with a group of people without sort of starting to like them or to sympathize with them. And, you know, it's a problem with traditional reporting insofar as it's harder to be objective if you are a prison officer and you endure what prison officers do, you know, some people are going to say, well, you're biased. You have this partiality. I think that the trick is you have to see that team spirit as a tool for learning about people, right? You want to know what makes that team work. How does that team think? How does the world look to them? Who are their friends? Who are their enemies? And to really get that, you kind of have to be on the team for a while, even if it's with this idea that, okay, after 3 months or 6 months or a year, I'm going to go back to my life off the team and write about that experience. So, you know, you have to be mindful of where you stand. And I remember the day that I came home and told my wife about working at Sing Sing, and I was saying, yeah, we had to do this. We had to do that. We had to put the cells on lockdown. And she said, so by we, who do you mean exactly? And I said, we, the COs. And it made me realize that I was now on the team, even though at the end of the day, I'd sit down and I'd take notes about what had happened. And that's, I think, a really good way to keep your perspective and sense of fairness, and remember that you're coming at this, you know, from the outside in a certain way. And so you need to write it down. And I just think writing it down, I think taking notes is so helpful, not just for remembering, but for keeping your identity straight, you know, keeping a grip on who you are and why you're doing this, and becoming sympathetic without going native.
That's a great way. I never thought about the note taking. Like, the note taking to me always made sense. Like, you need to document what's happening so you can verify everything and not rely on your memory. But as like I never thought of it as a way to keep your compass calibrated right, that to maintain your identity as a reporter on some level. Like, that's really interesting that it does sort of make sure it realigns and keeps your sort of journalist guitar in tune.
Yeah, exactly. And because, you know, after all, when you take notes, you're writing to yourself, right? These are notes for yourself. And so who is that person? It's a chance to, it's funny. The great challenge of writing my first book, Rolling Nowhere, was knowing who I was writing it to. Like, I'd always written for an editor at a newspaper or for a professor at a college, and you know who those people are and what they want. But when it comes to writing a book, like, who is this for exactly? And I remember my very first editor at the Viking Press said, you know, picture a really good friend who you haven't seen in a long time, who wants to know exactly what you've been through for the last months and likes you so much they're going to listen to it. And you're going to tell this person the truth, right? You're going to explain not just what happened, but how it mattered to you. And maybe, this will be after dinner and a couple glasses of wine or a beer. And that's great advice and helped me get through my first big writer's block, which came from not knowing who I was talking to. But I've never really thought about it this way. But yeah, when you take your own notes about a project, that audience is you, the writer, if that makes sense. It's like these are notes to the person who's going to be writing about this. And so you keep that identity alive. It's the identity of me wearing not my gray prison uniform with all my keys hanging on my belt and my baton and my baseball cap that says corrections, but it's me in my jeans and my sweatshirt sitting at home in front of my computer you know, with a soft drink or a coffee or something, and it's, I'm in my world and I'm writing to that future self who's going to put all this hopefully into a book. So yeah, the note taking is a big deal.
And you write in Immersion about the observer participant spectrum, and in a, you know, the nature of the work is, it can take months or years, and but you never quite know how long. And I wonder, like, what's your barometer for that? Like, do you find that you end the project when you become too close to the participant, or, you know, in the case of, say, like New Jack, you just wanted to, like, work for a year, and you kind of set those parameters or something. So, like, I don't know, like, how do you gauge how long a project might be along that spectrum?
So I think I do it by trying to imagine this experience on paper. And if the experience is the raw material, do I have enough to create a finished product? And it's funny, when I set out to ride the rails, you know, I basically just thought, okay, if I spend 4 months doing this, I will have had a bunch of experiences, and I could probably visit most of these states, and I could get home by Christmas. So I'll just aim to do it that long. But I wasn't consciously preparing to write a book. I ended up writing a college thesis, which is something very different, and I hadn't done that before either. But ever since then, I've understood there's a correspondence between the research and what you're going to write. And you kind of have to say to yourself, okay, where, if this is going to be a narrative, as all my books are, where are we in the story? What has happened to me so far? What have I learned? Who are my main characters, and how well do I know them? And I remember telling my agent about 3 months into working at Sing Sing. I said, "Well, I think I'm getting close. I think, I could see maybe 3 or 4 more weeks, another month, and then I think I can quit." And she said, "Oh, really?" Because it was a terrible job. I couldn't wait to be done. And, and she said, "Okay, so, we know where your book begins, and who do we meet along the way?" And I told her, and she said, "And how well do we get to know them?" And I said, "Well, not that well, but I said, I'm the main character. That's what matters." And she said, "Uh-huh. And the book ends when?" And I said, "Well, when I quit, obviously," with this stupid bravado. And she just looked at me like, "Seriously?" And I knew that I had to stay. And we had a couple more of those conversations where she basically helped me see that I didn't have all the pieces, which these pieces you can only gain through time. You only get to know somebody at work after weeks or months, right? And to get to know an institution as big as that prison, it takes months. It really does. So as the months went by, I tried to structure the book I hoped to write, and I could see where it began, and I could see that this could be the middle. And that day I got punched and started feeling differently about prisoners, like really disliking some of them who I didn't even know. I thought that's an important moment in my experience where the roughness got the better of me. And I said, that's going to be important in the book. And maybe that'll be around a midway point as I wrestle with keeping my cool and my perspective. And then, yeah, it was my agent who suggested maybe, you know, Christmas or New Year's will provide a sense of closure. And that was really smart. And once I had those under my belt and I'd seen what happens on New Year's Eve and realized that's a big deal in prison, where everyone's counting the days and here you are at the end of a year, I thought, okay, now I'm getting close to the end. So the process for me involves basically filling in my mind the chapters of a book I have yet to write. Do I have all the pieces yet? Can I go back to my study, or do I need to stay out here in the field a while longer?
You also write that when you were going through the experiences that would eventually become Rolling Nowhere, you sort of stumble upon what it's possibly like to be like a Mexican immigrant coming across, and which ultimately sort of was the tinder that led to Coyotes. And I wonder if you could maybe speak to this idea of like receptivity and always like keeping your antenna tuned to potential stories down the road, because that, you know, whenever you stumbled upon that during your experiences riding the rails ultimately turned into a second book, and you saw like a congruence between the hobos and the Mexican immigrants and so forth. So I wonder, like, how important is that level of receptivity, that, you know, and stowing that away for possibly a future book or a future magazine article?
Yeah, well, I guess it's important. I mean, it certainly mattered to me that I started meeting these Mexican guys on freight trains, which wasn't the picture I'd had in my mind when I started out. You know, I was thinking more about the grizzled hobos from the Depression era, and instead there's guys my age from Mexico who, to my surprise, you know, can understand my Denver Public School Spanish, and we're both, you know, on our own, and so we can hang out. I mean, that was a revelation, and it probably took me longer than it should have to realize these are the true modern day American hobos. I guess that's important. I guess that's how a lot of writers come upon their subjects, is by having some part of their brain open to new ideas and open to people who say things like, you really ought to meet my friend X who does Y, or did you ever think of writing about Z? Or, you know, I just think the genesis of ideas is mysterious. And occasionally my ideas come from somebody who's making a suggestion, but I think my best ideas, yeah, probably just come when a switch gets flicked in my mind and I think, oh, that's kind of cool. And yeah, I could get that story. I could do that. And if I wrote about a year of travel with Mexican immigrants, you know, I bet I could get that published. So it's absolutely essential, and it's absolutely mysterious. I have, you know, if I could take a pill every morning that would guarantee I'm going to notice interesting stories that that are suggested by the evening news or by you know, my daughter's looking at on Facebook or whatever, I would buy a year's supply.
Well, I think your taste as a reader and a writer just is sort of like a natural sort of inoculation to like these ideas. Like, you can see, like, if you see a little 100-word blurb, you're like, oh yeah, like you can almost plot out, like, there's arc there if you were given the gift of time and basically the gift of time and your own curiosity. Be like, oh yeah, that little piece of police blotter, there's more there, and that could be a real interesting story.
Right. And I think, yeah, you just kind of have to have faith in your instincts that, you know, you're interested for a good reason, or, you know, because there's a lot out there that interests us. I mean, you know, it's the cat video lobe of the brain that we have to keep under control and put in its proper place while we also pay attention to other things, right? I mean, channeling and sort of tending to one's own impulses, one's own curiosity can be a big job. And then you need a council of advisors, right? You need somebody to say, oh, that, I think that's been done, or that doesn't sound like you, or that's such an interesting and mysterious subject to me.
Yeah. And when you were attending a party in New York City, and you crossed paths with David Remnick, and you know, he said to you, like, oh yeah, that's the writer who makes his living sleeping on the ground. And yeah. I was wondering, like, how did you take that? What was the context of that, and how did you take that?
It's funny. I was delighted to be recognized. You know, for my first two books, which had involved a lot of sleeping on the ground, but B, I was mortified, because can you really sleep on the ground for your whole career? And oddly, it made me think of that long-running TV show Gilligan's Island, which has had, you know, this cast of characters who I watched for years on TV, and who I think in not only my mind but everybody's were forever identified with this sort of light comedy. And you know, that's Gilligan, that's Ginger, and you get typecast, and if you're too closely identified with one thing, I think it's a problem. So yeah, I think that was a factor in me choosing to write about Aspen for my third book, to see if this technique of participant observation could be used with people wealthier than me, as well as less wealthy. So it definitely had an effect.
Yeah. And like, do you think there's a point, or maybe there's just a way that you can, I don't know, recalibrate it, if you will? Like, is there an expiration date to this type of reporting, or just maybe a certain subgenre of it? Like, I imagine you right now, the idea of riding the rails and sleeping on the floor and sleeping on the ground and crossing the Mexican border is abhorrent. But when you were 25, it was like, yeah, so I'm going to do this. So, yeah.
Well, here's the thing. It's not abhorrent. It's like, it still seems kind of cool. But I know that, you know, I'm in my late 50s now, and I could still ride the rails. And in fact, a couple of summers ago, I did with my son.
I'll write that piece for Outside.
Yeah, he was curious about it, and it was a way for me to get back out there. But I think really the, you know, I've thought about this. Some things would probably be harder for me to do now. And there's a chapter of my book about roads, The Roots of Man, which is set in Kashmir, in northern India, in Ladakh, where I walked on a frozen river for 3 days with these teenagers who were getting out of their isolated valley to attend school on the outside. And I was thinking, well, at a certain point, you know, what is the expiration date? How long could I keep doing this? And I think, as long as, you're in decent shape, yeah, you can keep going, but it does feel a little riskier to do certain things now. And also, you know, once you have a family, once you have kids, it seems a little selfish to be transported across the Rio Grande by members of a Mexican gang than it did before you had a family. So yeah, both, I guess, physical fitness and your ties to people close to you affect your ability to do this. But I would, you know, a couple of my ideas for future projects are sort of like the early projects, and I would do them if the various pieces can come together.
And I know, you know, Sebastian Younger has spoken about, I think he's kind of done doing the war reporting, like going into war zones. Like I've heard him say that on podcasts, and like, that's kind of the idea. It's like, I think war correspondents and foreign correspondents, like who have been really in the thick of things, like at some point you're like, it's time to step away from this. And like you, you know, you cite his work and his little passage on PTSD in immersion as well. And he's spoken in some of your classes. So I wonder, you know, just have you guys gone back and forth, talking about this very subject?
Yeah, it's funny. We have, I admire him tremendously. And, you know, I admire writers who will put themselves out there with soldiers and report from the front. My wife and I made a bargain early in our relationship that, you know, she could handle most things, but did I think I could avoid doing that kind of reporting? And, after a couple of false starts, I figured out that I could. It was hard to say no a couple of times, but I did. But I do think Sebastian is done with war reporting, and you know, his close collaborator Tim Hetherington, who he did Restrepo and other projects with, was killed in Libya, as you know. And I think at a certain point you decide, this is taking a toll on me, and I've also maybe cheated death enough that if I kept doing it, I could expect not to at some point. And so yes, you see people ease out of it and become interested in a life that does not involve so much risk or fear. And you know, Chris Hedges, also a former war reporter, has written a lot about the effects of that kind of research. But Sebastian has really, I think, done more than anybody else to talk about how trauma can mess up a war correspondent as well. And I admire him for that. I think, you know, right, we have to take care of ourselves as writers, and some of the things you see aren't easy, and some of those things don't leave your mind as quickly as you'd like, if at all, and you have to pay attention to that.
And you cite a bunch, just dozens upon dozens of, you know, brilliant writers in your book, you know, Susan Orlean, Younger, Adrian Nicole LeBlanc, Tracy Kidder, Maddie Blaze. And over the course of your career, what have you learned from these practitioners and other practitioners about the craft of this type of immersion reporting and the writing that comes out of it?
Wow, what have I learned? I guess I've learned, you know, I've tried to take lessons from people, as you know, wherever I can. And from Susan Orlean, you remember that writing doesn't have to be about war to be good, to be meaningful, to transport a reader. I mean, She, more than almost any of the writers I talk about in my book, is a writer who, when you come across her work, you know it's her. If you'd forgotten to pay attention to the byline, I think, and you were perceptive, you'd figure it out within a few paragraphs that this is Susan Orlean. And that's such an important lesson for nonfiction writers, that that we can have a style too, and that it consists of how we look at things, and obviously in our language, but also in our choice of topics. That things can be funny, things can be delightful, and we should pay attention, right? I'm reading a new book that isn't out yet about a writer who spent a year in a classroom for recent immigrants, most of them refugees, in Denver. Her name's Helen Thorpe. And I keep getting reminded of Tracy Kidder's book, Among School Children, which has the same basic idea. You know, he spent a year in this classroom, but they're doing it in such different ways. And, you know, Kidder has been hugely influential to me. He's such a master of long form narrative. And, you know, I've tried to channel and soak up, the way I imagine him doing his reporting sometimes, the care with which he comes to characterize people important to him, whether it's, you know, Dr. Paul Farmer in Haiti in Mountains Beyond Mountains, or the doctor from Burundi, who he writes about in that amazing book whose name is escaping me right now. The reason I quote those people in Immersion is each of them have left me with lessons that I think made me a better writer, or could make me a better writer if I could attend to them properly, and hopefully might help other people wanting to do this too. I kind of think we're all in a kind of conversation with each other when we write our books, and I mean, that's what it's all about.
Well, I think what's especially great about Orlean and Kidder is that they, especially with Kidder's early work, they kind of dispels the myth that immersion writing has to be like this almost foreign deep dive into war, or you know, crossing the Mexican border. You know, it can be something that's, you can do immersion reporting in your backyard.
Right. And exactly.
Yeah.
No, that's a really good point. And yeah, Catherine Boo as well. Mm-hmm. I guess she's probably best known now for Behind the Beautiful Forevers about India, but built her reputation on very local topics, familiar to all kinds of Americans. And yeah, I got started with subjects that cost me very little, and that I, you know, often I found that working a job, you know, whether it's driving a taxi in Aspen or working corrections in New York, is itself an interesting thing to write about, but it also pays you while you're doing it, which is, an important factor for a lot of us.
A real interesting point you make in the book has to do with research, and you said there's a point too. I guess it helps focusing the research, and in turn like helps focus the writing later. You know, you call it like steering your research.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, how important is that? There's got to be a spectrum there, because if you steer the research too much, you're not being receptive to other things that might crop up. So like, how do you navigate those two poles between steering the research and then being open to anything that happens?
Yeah, it's funny. It's connected to the question of how much do you research your t- topic, say I'm, you know, you're going to another country or another city, how much of an expert do you have to be on that place before you go there? Mm. And I think you need to do some basic research. So you've got the basic touchstones, you know, important history, you know, important books and other media, musicians, you know what's happening politically, but you don't want to overdo it because, yeah, you have to stay open to surprise and to the unexpected. So, you know, I guess I look for some kind of middle ground where I'm receptive to what I find, but I also, I'm not going in blind and just waiting to see what happens. There's questions I want to ask. And you also find, well, here's an example. You know, my first piece for the New Yorker was about a journey from Mombasa, Kenya, into Central Africa to write about long-distance truck drivers and AIDS, which was spreading among men and women in Africa before it was understood very well in the United States how that could happen. How do women get infected? And in fact, yeah, how do straight guys get infected? And a couple of friends of mine from college had become ill with a disease, and I wanted to write something about it. And so I pursued this story about travel with these drivers who they're away from home for weeks at a time. And yes, they hook up with waitresses and, you know, women serving them drinks at little lodgings along the way. But it was really hard for me to talk to those women who were clearly a big part of the story. Because the truck drivers were the only translators I had. And so when I went back to Kenya and revisited one of those drivers for my book about roads, I purposefully thought I want to flesh out poor choice of words. I want to explore this other part of the story. Right? Because I've been hanging out with men. It's important to see the other side of things, and found a way to do that in Nairobi, which turned out to be really affecting because it took me so long to understand that even though these women were infected, they were most of them still doing sex work because their children depended on them for it. And that was just such a revelation and such a dilemma. And they acted like I would have some good advice for them, which I really struggled with. And so, yeah, you also go in thinking, how can I compensate for some bias I might bring to this, say, by being a man or any of the other parts of my identity that might keep me from thinking about other people's situations? So that's another thing I do think about.
So once you've done, you know, most or all of your research and you're getting ready to organize your notes and get down to the writing of it, what's your approach to writing in your routine once you're looking to start to mold and craft a narrative, sort of like, you know, how do you operate, you know, morning routine to win the day so you can start? Yeah. So yeah, I'll just leave it at that.
I like that idea, win the day. I like that because we all know how bad it feels when we've lost the day, right?
Oh yeah.
Usually arrives with beer around 6 or 7 p.m. and surrender. I take some time. I don't think it's if you can possibly not start writing right away, I think that's a good thing. Just let the pieces settle in your brain a little bit and then I read back over all my notes. I see if there's any more reporting I need to do, another book I need to read, or somebody I forgot to talk to. And then I just try to think, okay, do I have a story? Where should I begin? What'll be the high points? I do the kind of outline where, you know, I try to put things in order, and I try to make a little notation for everything that really has to be in there. Like that conversation with the sex workers in Nairobi has to be in there. And my conversation with the truck driver about illness has to be in that. So there's stuff that you just know is really important and you have to use. So I try to order it, and I try to think, okay, if I'm going to talk about all these things and I've got X number of words, how much time can I spend on each of them? So you just try to get, it's like planting a garden or something. I'm up here in New Hampshire right now, and I was actually talking to a neighbor yesterday who was planting her garden, and she had strings laid out in these very straight rows, and she had seedlings she had planted months before. I mean, it's not like she just got out there and said, today I plant my garden. In fact, she'd clearly been working on it for weeks. And I think the best kind of writing will have the same kind of preparation. It's not like you sit down and okay, today I write. Rather, you've been getting ready to write for a long time, and now you finally have cleared the decks, and you're gonna write, which to me means doing some every day, as consistently as you can until it's done. So I look for a block of time that doesn't have a week of obligation in the middle of it, right? Or some medical thing. I don't want mm-hmm. to have that happen here. I want to be able to concentrate on what I'm doing. You need to kind of clear the decks for as long as it will take, if you have that luxury. You know, if you're a person who works another job as well, then you have to say, okay, I'm going to work on this the next 4 weekends. You have to set out the time so that your brain knows that's what you're going to do then. And that to me is the key. So like when I go to bed the night before a day of writing, it's somewhere in my mind. Some part of my brain is getting ready to write the next day. And it's not like I'm planning sentences or an outline in my mind. It's just maybe I just think your mind helps you if you prepare in a conscious way. It will help you unconsciously get ready. And in the old days, I really didn't start writing until after lunch, when my first 3 books were all written in afternoons. But as I've gotten older, I've started writing earlier in the day. But when I say a good day of writing, I don't write all day, and I don't know anybody who does. You know, if you have 2 or 3 concentrated hours of writing, and by concentrated hours, I mean hours punctuated by standing up, by stretching, by pouring another cup of coffee, by, you know, maybe answering that text or email, but not more than one. And then back to it. And then maybe if you're really energetic, coming back to it in the afternoon, that's a day of writing for me. And I used to start by reviewing everything I'd written the day before and making sure it was still good. And somewhere along the way, I stopped doing that. I pick up where I left off. I try to leave off at a place where I'm not stuck, but rather I've got momentum, right? So I haven't quite finished writing that scene, but I know where I'm going, and I'm actually kind of looking forward to it. And that kind of helps you get off to a running start. If I'm having trouble just putting words together, I might write an email to a friend just to get the wheels turning.
Yeah, I think Hemingway used to just sometimes stop right in the middle of a sentence, leaving a little in the well, so you pick up.
Yeah,
the next
I love
day.
That. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that's a cool idea. And, so anyway,
yeah. How do you deal with those ugly middles in a draft when like the early momentum and that early like honeymoon period of the book has subsided and you got a slog. How do you deal with that? Because that's like an ugly part for anyone, whether it's writing essays or something book length. It's just sometimes it's a grind and it's not fun anymore. And it's like, ugh. How do you approach that?
We've all been there. And sometimes we've been sent there by our editor or our agent or someone who says, you need to make this better. And it can be excruciating. God, how do I deal with it? I don't know. How do any of us deal with torture and hardship? We, you try to approach it methodically. You think, how could I just do this for an hour today, an hour a day for the next 2 weeks and get through it and reward myself at night by seeing a movie or, doing something fun. I don't have a magic formula for getting through those hard parts other than to acknowledge we all have them. And even, the most prolific writer who is consistently celebrated is going to run into a morass now and then where mm-hmm. she just has to, where she's going to hate her life until that's done. And then hopefully, an end will approach. But the bigger thing is to avoid a situation like that that's too massive, right? Like getting involved in a book that's just going to have a lot of awful brush to hack your way through. I think you have to, anything you truly dread, that should be a sign that this is maybe not where you want to spend weeks. Hopefully this middle part you're talking about can be addressed in, before it drives us to depression or something.
Yeah. You've been doing this kind of work for 40 years, which when you say it out loud, it's like, holy crap. What motivates you at this point after doing this for so long? Like what motivates and what keeps driving you?
Oh man. Well, what makes any of us want to meet an interesting new person? I guess there's some of us who are done meeting new people, but not me. And, I also, think of it as my continuing education in the world. It's a continuing process of discovery and figuring things out. And also maybe of shining a light onto places where I think could use it. I think that can be part of the writer's job as well. And Lord knows, there's plenty of those. And, I see no reason to, I still want to get up every day. And for me, getting up in the morning involves thinking about what I'm going to write about or research. It's just kind of what I do and who I am in the world. So, I hope to have a few more books before I'm done.
Oh, fantastic. Well, that's, and I deeply look forward to reading more of your work. And I know you've got some projects in the hopper, so I can't wait to find out what those are down the road.
I appreciate you attending so closely to immersion, and it's really, really fun to talk to you about this.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thanks again thanks again, Ted, for carving out this time, and it's been a pleasure. Immersion is just, you know, it's so good, and all your past work are just perfect illustrations of the tactics that you wrote about here. So thanks for that, and we'll be in touch down the road.
Thanks, Brendan. Look forward to it.
You got it. Take care.
Yep. Bye.
So long. This week's program was produced by yours truly, Brendan O'Mara. Thanks very much for listening. Subscribe, share, review. And if I could leave you with one piece of advice this week, it would be this.
It's the cat video lobe of the brain that we have to keep under control and put in its proper place.
Perfect. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.